produces an economy model of the famous color pack camera for half the price of the original. Same great film. Same fast loading. Same electric eye. Yet it's half the price of the original model. You get the same beautiful color prints in 60 seconds, black and white in 10, in the same big size. Yet it's half the price of the original model. Isn't it your turn to own a Polaroid color pack camera?
There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
If I had a talking picture of you, I would run it every time I felt blue. I would sit there in the gloom of my lonely little room and applaud each time you whispered, I love you, on the screen the moment you came in view. We would talk the whole thing over, we two. I would give 10 shows a day and a midnight matinee if I had a talking picture of you.
Imagine for a moment. It's February 2017. You walk to your mailbox and discover the latest issue of Vanity Fair has arrived. A shirtless Chris Pratt adorns the cover. Thumbing through the pages, you stumble onto a headline that reads, An Eye to Remember. This was how much of America first learned about or even heard the name Lucia Nelson. Lucia Nelson was a promising young photographer who worked for Condé Nast publications from 1932 to 1938 and ran in prominent photography circles with the likes of Edward Steichen and Alfred Stieglitz. Best remembered for striking modern portraits of American celebrities and elegant fashion photography, Nelson also pursued documentary photography before his untimely death at the age of 30 in 1938. For all intents and purposes, the artist and his work were all but forgotten for over 75 years. Through a series of rather fortunate events, Nelson's archive made it to Philbrook. Today we're sitting down with Philbrook Chief Curator Catherine Whitney to talk about this once-in-a-lifetime story and much more.
The funny thing was, it was a pass along from a colleague who had transcribed this on a note and said, somebody called about this collection, thousands of photographs, the name Edward Steichen was mentioned. And I remember thinking, okay, this is going to be a wild card. So I called, and the person on the other end started to describe what she had and said hundreds or thousands of photographs and explained why she was in Tulsa and what was happening. And so I said, you know, maybe this would make sense for me to come out and see. But she basically wanted advice, what to do with this collection, how to place it, how to assess it, maybe to sell it. So I basically went out there to talk to her, to see what she had, and to give her advice about how to place it.
And this is something that happens a lot. In the museum world, we are constantly getting a barrage of inquiries about appraisals, about, I think I have this thing that my grandma had and what's it worth or would you like to have it? So this is not something new in our world.
It's not new at all. We get a handful of calls every week and often it's, oh, I found this in the attic. My grandmother gave this to me. I found this at a garage sale down the street. We have this piece in our collection or our friends have this piece. Do you know anything about this? Can you offer research? We don't generally do research on other people's collections. We also don't offer valuations. We just can't.
Yeah, we're not Antiques Roadshow.
We're not that, right. But, you know, we're happy to share what knowledge we have and refer them to appraisers or specialists if we're not knowledgeable in that area. So it was just a follow-up call. It's something we do regularly. Once in a while, you'll find something that might turn into a really nice donation or rarely a purchase, but usually you will pursue the call as a service and also to see if there's a potential donation that might be appropriate to your collection or somebody else in the community.
And so you hear a name like Edward Steichen, which is a big deal name, and you hear about the quantity. You see, you know, thousands. So those things did pique your interest, and you go see this work. When's the moment where you start to realize this is something? This is not just one of those random calls, but this is actually something that might be of interest to us.
So I walked into the house where the collection was in a series of boxes, and the owner had arranged them basically thematically. By sitter, by location, by European landscapes, by nudes. And when I started to see really important celebrities from the period, from Sherwood Anderson to artist John Sloan to Olympic athlete Jesse Owens to portraits.
People like Katharine Hepburn.
Actresses Gary Cooper. And then also the quality. And then the sheer quantity. There were thousands of images, negatives. Beautiful black and white. Some, you know, variety of quality. Some were excellent, beautiful works that you might compare with some of the bigger names of the
20s, these are 80 30s. Years old plus by now at this point, you know. Yeah.
But to see the major names, celebrities, actors, writers, artists of the day. You realize, okay, this was somebody. If he had these major actors and actresses, athletes, writers posing for him, he was somebody. Who was this guy?
Yeah, how was he getting access to these people?
Right.
Yeah.
So I went back, spoke to our former director, Rand Suffolk, at the time. He said, maybe I should come out this time. I said, please do. And I was envisioning just
the buddy system.
Yes, a lot of little spotlight shows. Oh, we could do this great show on circus acrobats of the 1930s.
Because there's so many different areas.
So many different subjects, from commercial beautiful still lives and product placement to beautiful fashion shots to celebrities, as I said, to even beautiful scenes of New York City.
Yeah, these man on the street kind of photos.
To Depression era.
Stuff that you would associate with Dorothea Lange style Depression
era
photography.
Photographs. So Rand came out with me and his eyes got big. And again, we were kind of planning to advise what could this person do. And then we just started saying, wow, this is really good stuff. And he even said to me, this is really good stuff, right? I said, this is really good stuff. So we realized this was really a find. This was a rare thing. This was not something that happens every day. It was good quality. It was huge in terms of quantity. And we didn't know who this guy was, but we knew a lot of his subjects.
So you've spent the last few years, because this was several years ago, and this process has been arduous and long, and a lot of work that's gone into it. And it's been a learning experience. We're still learning things about Lucia Nelson. But who was Lucia Nelson as far as this guy who we still don't know everything
right.
about?
Right. Lucia Nelson is a mystery. So Lucia Nelson was a Jewish immigrant from Latvia. He was born in 1907. Age 15, he basically immigrated to the United States.
By himself.
By himself. Wow. Ran away, essentially, to find more adventures in life. He worked on a ship and basically left without permission to leave. And so an immigrant to New York City. And then the picture gets really, really foggy. We don't know. We realize he had a lot of odd jobs. He worked up at the Catskills, probably as a sous chef for a couple of years, did odd jobs, somehow got a hold of a camera, possibly enrolled in photography school. We don't know. And then by 1932, all of a sudden, he's getting married. He is having some photographs published in the New York Times and other journals. And then in the fall of 1932, he's made a staff photographer at Condé Nast, working for Vanity Fair and eventually for Vogue magazine.
It's just amazing that there's this gap where, and in some ways, that remains the biggest mystery. How does this guy who was a undocumented worker, you know, who knows what his level of speaking English was,
right.
We have no idea, came over here. How does he make that jump from working at a Catskills restaurant to being a staff photographer for something like Vanity Fair or Vogue. It's really a fascinating thing. But what have you learned in the last couple of years that you didn't know when you first acquired the collection?
Well, we've learned a lot. The person who owned the collection previously had done about 4 years of research with some friends. So she had done a lot of researching who his subjects were, doing Wikipedia searches, who's Katharine Hepburn, what were her movies, when might he have photographed her. But we dug in deep as much as we could. There were only two published articles on him, one by his wife after he died, and one by Edward Steichen, who, as you mentioned, was one of the great photographers of the 20th century and was his mentor.
And he was the art director for Condé Nast.
Right. Yeah. So you realize when Edward Steichen is penning an article on Lucia Nelson and showing photographs that Lucia did of the other great 20th century photographer, Alfred Stieglitz, who Lucia photographed in his summer home in Lake George, upstate New York, you realize there was a really important connection there. But how that happened is still a huge mystery. So we have those two published articles, one from his wife that was kind of more subjective.
And she died not long after him.
She died in 1950, I believe. Yeah. So she outlived him by a bit. But how did she survive after? You know, in the 30s, your husband dies. One piece I forgot to mention was that Lucia was a photographer for about 6 years. 2 years after he started at Condé Nast, he was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma and died right before his 31st birthday.
And that's one thing that's kind of come to light, because when the collection was first acquired, we didn't even know his cause of death.
That's right,
at the time. So there have been documents, like I believe a death certificate and other things that have been uncovered or found since that time. So I wonder, have you ever had a project like this? Because we talk about this all the time, and you read these stories about someone like Vivian Meyer,
exactly,
or some of these big profile things about
discoveries
of photographers. And this was different because he was an established photographer. He wasn't just, you know, he had an actual professional job doing things like that. But for the most part, everyone I've ever mentioned him to up till before this show opened had never heard of him.
Right.
So, and I'm sure that you and our previous director hadn't heard of him either.
Right.
Was it solely based on the quality of the work that you decided to do this? Because you knew that no one else probably had any name recognition. And so did the work just speak for itself enough to say, we want to try to introduce this person back into the public consciousness?
Yes and no. We realized because the work was of great quality, there was something there. We also recognized, as I said, a lot of his sitters were very famous personalities of the time. So we did find his name listed in a couple, like a Vanity Fair retrospective book, but not a lot of details were given. A lot of photography specialists know of Lucia Nelson, and these are people who are highly specialized in 1930s photography. They've heard of him, but they didn't have a lot of details. His name came up as an exhibitor at MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, in 1937, when they did their very first retrospective of photography. So he had some prominence.
This would have been
there
around the 100th anniversary of photography,
right,
you know, being invented, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So with prominent Americans and European photographers, we also called some museums that were known for photography. And a couple people were aware of him or had, you know, he's in the George Eastman House in the collection. He was also at the National Portrait Gallery. So he's in a very few collections and one or two pieces here and there. But again, the depth of who he was and what he did was missing.
Well, he has a couple of images that when you see them, and I don't know if this is because they ring a certain bell, but the Jesse Owens portrait, for example, the Peter Lorre, the actor image, which is a still from his film Crime and Punishment.
Right.
They're images that, to me, I felt I had seen before.
Exactly.
So there are a couple of these things that maybe, even though he was not known, maybe the image was iconic enough to where it kind of bled out into the into the broader sphere. And so we get the work. We have these thousands of images, thousands of negatives. We don't know what to do with this. Mm-hmm. And then the idea comes to do an exhibition. And like you said, there are so many different areas. You could have done one about one area, one about celebrities, one about circus, one about all these different things. But you kind of decided to take a different tack on that and do something that's a little bit more of a broad survey of the different areas. How was that process kind of determined?
Well, I think having one artist's archive like this, especially an artist that is very talented but has been lost, you have a very awesome responsibility and privilege, but responsibility to introduce him to the public. So we realized we needed to introduce him properly. Who is the man behind the lens? What did he do? What were some of his subjects and his what was his context? So our show that we did, Lucian Nelson Photographs, Celebrity, the Forgotten Man in 1930s America at Philbrook, was really an introduction to who Lucia is, what his legacy was. It was really just the cream off the top. Where we are now going forward is that, as you said, we have this archive of thousands of photographs, some negatives and some ephemera, some tear sheets from Vanity Fair and Vogue, where he worked, and we're trying to reconstruct those missing pieces that we still don't know. You asked how we found out some of these missing pieces. We looked at immigration records. We had a marriage certificate. You look up death certificates. We actually found through our website two granddaughters that are still alive who had always known about him and wanted to know more. So that was a really rich relationship and experience that we've had. And we even just heard from one of the granddaughters over New Year's and had a really nice exchange. And that's been a really great professional friendship. So filling in the details. But now moving forward, I think our plan or our goals are to share his legacy and his output with other museums, to tour a show, which we can scale up or scale down depending on the size of the interested exhibitor, possibly donate some duplicate images of different sitters and scenes. We also hope at some point or have an ideal wish to have some sort of residency for interns or for researchers to come in and dive deeper into pockets of depth within the collection. We also hope to integrate his work within our own permanent collection, some more sort of thematic installations within our own collection, tie it into 1930s America, contextualize his art within the wider American picture in the 1930s.
Because photography historically had not been a major area of focus for the museum. But now, because of the sheer size of this collection, it is a pretty big chunk now of what the museum has. I wonder, that exhibition, which was opened in early 2017, mm-hmm. were you surprised with the reaction? Because it seemed like people were thrilled. I mean, Vanity Fair, New York Magazine, there was a lot of national press about this. People seemed really fascinated with the mystery and the story behind it. What were you expecting as far as, you know, introducing someone that no one knew? Did you have any sense of how this would play in the world?
This far exceeded my expectations. And the exciting thing was that our whole museum staff, I think, was really eager and excited about this show. And it showed in our presentation. And the way the communications team presented this found mystery and how we kind of recreated a newspaper from the era with some of his photographs. People were crazy for this show. I knew that photography was popular in Tulsa and in our region. It is a growing area of interest for the museum staff as well as our audiences. And so I knew photography was popular, but I had no idea that it would be received like this. And frankly, it was exceedingly exciting, and people had so much connection to this. It really surprised us.
So this show you did, most of our shows we do with one curator does the show, but you had a partner on this journey,
yes.
which was Sarah Lees, who is our curator of European
yes.
art. And obviously, since, you know, he was a European artist who came to America,
yep.
there was that interesting crossover. But also, was that partly because it was such a big undertaking? You know, what was the purpose of having two curators?
Yes. Dr. Sarah Lees was the co-curator, and unfortunately she can't be here today because she got struck down with laryngitis, but I wish she were here to help fill in the
gaps. She might sound like Lauren Bacall, though,
yeah,
if we had her here.
Yeah, she's got a very sexy voice today, but you can barely hear her. Yeah, Sarah added an incredible element to the show, which was she's a very ardent researcher. And she, being the curator of European art, was kind of interested in his history and you know, what was the connection Latvia to the Russian Empire at the time and his immigration status and how all that worked. But also piecing together his very personal elements. When did this happen? What happened next? She's sort of a detective, a research detective, in terms of she really wanted to know, when was that first photograph? I mean, we actually have a photograph that says, my first photograph with a 9x12.
Yeah, let's talk about this for a second. Camera. I mean, talk about, do you remember the moment when you kind of realized that as part of this broader collection, there was literally not just having the first photograph, which would be very difficult to determine if you don't have the right research, but it actually says, photograph.
We almost went, that doesn't
just
happen.
Too real.
Researchers don't get that that gift. But it is a photograph, we think, from about 1928 of a single woman sitting in a chair in like an apartment or maybe an office, very kind of a solemn, beautiful, straightforward look on her face. And it says, my first photograph with a 9x12 camera or any camera. So that was our starting point.
I mean, just to have something like that in the artist's own hand, just telling you, hey, look at this. This is important, you know, and obviously he wanted to remember that moment as well.
Right.
The reaction was really interesting from the public. We know that photography is popular. It seemed to me, watching guests in the show, people spend a lot of time in there. A lot of shows, unfortunately, with paintings, for example, if you watch people behavior-wise in the gallery, they kind of do the quick run-through, and they'll look for a second. Maybe they'll read the label. They often don't. So behavior is very different. But in a show, and I think I see this often in photography shows, people really seem to linger, mm-hmm. and they look at it, and they look deeper into it, and they look at the label, the caption. What do you think it is about that? Is it because it's easier to relate to? Why is photography more accessible, do you think?
That's a good question. I think because they realize, you know, that standard cliche when you look at art, oh, I could have done that. Well, when you have a camera, anybody can do it. But why does one photograph?
My kid could do that kind of thing.
Why does one photograph strike you so much more or get your attention or beg you to look more carefully? So I think a lot, and also it's realism, right? It's real, even if it's modernist or atmospheric, however they've kind
of
manipulated.
I've been to the Chrysler building. I know what that is.
Yeah, I've been there. I know that. Or my grandmother had those salt and pepper shakers that he's presenting in the still life. I think people want to say, how did he make this into art? How is it not just a snapshot of life? How is this artful? What has he done here? And what am I looking at? And have I experienced
it? It seems like there's a narrative, too. I would hear people talking about, you know, what happened before this moment?
Right.
What was happening right after that moment? You know, there's images of a crowd, a big image of a crowd where there's hundreds of people, but one person is looking directly at the camera, you know, so you make eye contact with that person and that kind of becomes your focus. So there is something really interesting with the way visitors engage with photography as opposed to other forms. You talked about this big responsibility. It's rare for a museum to have basically the entire life's work of one artist. Mm-hmm. And that's basically where we are with this.
Right.
We have this archive and we don't have that with any other artist. So it really does fall to Philbrook as an institution to be the steward for this material. And you mentioned that there, you know, this stuff's 80 plus years old, some of it, and there are condition issues.
Right.
And think about just the literal physical protection and maintenance of this stuff. You know, are there any fears about how this stuff will last or survive, you know, for the next 80 years?
Absolutely. Condition for film is a huge challenge, to be frank. A lot of the historic film, there were two types of film, nitrate and cellulose acetate. And one form, nitrate, is fragile, even combustible after periods of time and certain degradation. So we were very aware of not only our responsibility to care for this material and not have it get worse or degrade further, but safety issues. So we actually consulted with the National Park Service guidelines on how to care for some of these negatives in particular and disposed of properly some that were either too far gone or we could never use. We also ideally hope to get a grant or some resources in the future to possibly digitize some of these negatives that aren't degraded too much. Some of them are. Some of them are degraded. But for the most part, we were really pleased to find what excellent condition these were in, given their age.
And was that an accident? Because it wasn't as if for, you know, between 1938 when he dies and when we get them in the, you know, 2015 or whenever that was, it wasn't as if they'd been held in some perfectly climate-controlled vault in the side of a mountain right. in Switzerland or right. something. These were at one point in some kind of like dresser or bureau
right.
they were actually in a filing cabinet.
Yeah. The mysterious filing cabinet yeah. that the granddaughters knew about. Right. What happened was when the only daughter was moving, she lived in Brooklyn, and a neighbor actually purchased the entire estate in 1983. And so the collection followed this new private collector for a better part of 30 years, from basically basement to attic when they moved a couple times.
In a filing cabinet.
In the filing cabinet and in some boxes. So the good news is they were protected from the light. They didn't have excessive fading because they weren't exposed to sunlight, natural light. And presumably they were kept relatively cool, but who knows? It depends on, you know, the situation in that house. So in some ways they were in excellent shape for their age. We actually had them looked at in Texas. A museum conservator of photography looked at them and said they were in actually very good condition for their age and didn't need a lot of intervention. But the, you know, as I said, we'd love sometime to get a grant and either digitize or repair things that still can be conserved at this point.
This installment of Museum Confidential is brought to you by the phrase, "My kid could do that." A conversational aside or museum-going observation that's probably as old as the very notion of human beings displaying art on walls, from galleries back to caves. "My kid could do that" is, of course, a boneheaded judgment, a stupid from-the-hip evaluation, and a dismissive expression of the idea that this particular blank that we're looking at is so sloppy, inferior, amateurish, or simplistic that it is clearly of a childlike quality. We at Museum Confidential would like to offer the following three correctives. One, "My kid could do that" as an assessment is actually unfair, unkind, and uninformed. Two, "Your kid didn't do that. An artist did that, and that's kind of the point." Three, which builds on points one and two and is a quote from Picasso, "Every child is an artist. The problem is how to remain an artist once he grows up."
So the exhibition of these, which was, what, 100 plus images out of thousands?
Yeah.
Was really just like skimming the surface. And there's all these different areas. I wonder, is there an area of his focus that kind of appeals to you the most? I'm guessing it's probably this kind of Depression era, man on the street kind
How
of stuff,
did you
because
know?
I just know that that's your particular focus. But he seems so skilled in so many different things. But do you think he, from a critical point of view, had a specific gift in one area or another?
Yeah, I think portraiture was really his forte. I think he really liked humanity. I think he was a nice guy. I think he was very socially adept from what I've read. I think he was pretty smooth. And he really liked getting to know people. And he talked about really he liked sittings and getting to know people. He felt like he could get to know sitters and capture celebrities better if he knew them in advance, like celebrities. But he would actually take time to get to know his sitters. I think he had a lot of sympathy and social meaning and messaging in his work. He worked for a lot of charities in the 1930s, which was a very difficult time in America. He had a very sympathetic lens. So I think he loved the documentary photography and the everyday man. He loved things like the traveling circus and scenes of leisure and popular culture and performance.
Yeah, I love the ones where people getting food at a stand in Coney Island
or right. the custard stand,
or there's a donut shop
right.
or all these
hot
different things.
Stands,
yeah, hot dog
yeah.
stands and things like that. Well, it's interesting you mentioned portraiture because it seems like the truly great portraits capture the personality of the person mm-hmm. in a still moment, mm-hmm. right? So Katharine Hepburn's is mysterious and kind of dark and elegant in a certain kind of way.
And,
yeah, kind of not quite there.
Not
and Gary Cooper's is very stoic, right. just like you think of him. And someone like Edward Hopper, the painter, great painter, looks really angry in his
looks
picture.
Back at you.
You
right.
know, and he's kind of like leering at you. And, you know, and if you know anything about him, he seemed to have some, a little bit of a temper. But he also had this amazing sense of humor.
Yeah.
There are some really silly portraits. Yeah. You know, there's a famously one we made had a lot of fun with in the show, which was a foot, a man's foot with glasses on it and a bow tie and all these different things. And it becomes this kind of human almost, you know.
It looks almost like a Muppet.
Yeah, it does have kind of a cartoony.
Like Beaker or something.
Yeah, a cartoony element. But there were also other moments of humor. Here we are, you know, a year after the show. Do you feel like you've gotten to know this person? You know, someone so removed. I mean, he died decades ago. But do you kind of feel like you know Lucia Nelson in a way that a lot of people don't because you spent more time thinking about him?
Definitely. But there were a lot of mysteries, and that sort of bothers me still. Like, how did he get that job?
Is that the big thing to you, that kind of gap between?
That gap is huge for me. Did he go to art school? Who did he train under? You know, he worked for Steichen. Was he a student of Steichen's?
And you know, of course, we think about where would he have gone? What could he have been? You know, because he seemed to be on the track of being one of the greats, especially at age 30. You know?
36 years in his career, and you wonder what he could have done if he had
the body
lived
of work
into his
70s, was amazing.
Right? And if he had lived through these incredible, if he had lived through the 1950s and knew Robert Frank, and if he had experienced the civil rights movement in the 1960s and had been a photojournalist for that long, I mean, how would his art have transformed? What images of America could he have captured?
When you talk about a sympathetic lens, you know, he was a Jewish photographer. There was a revolution in Latvia. Mm-hmm. It was not a good time to be Jewish in Latvia at the time. There's a story about him going over to Latvia and bringing someone back with him. That's not quite
his sister back.
Yeah. But on the papers, it's listed as Mrs. Lucia Nelson, I believe,
right,
on the travel documents.
The sister, Lazare.
Because the wife was already still here.
The wife was here. And then he ended up going back to Europe with the wife, who was pregnant. Probably because he knew it was maybe one of his last chances to go back to his homeland and see it.
Because of his illness?
Because of his
illness. Or because
illness,
of the political turmoil.
Also political instability in the region.
But, and, you know, and of course, we get into a few years later, you know, if he had lived, he would have been right in the midst
of
World War II and all the things that were happening. You know, so it would have been interesting to see where his lens would have turned in a more political, social, you know, because it had been so heavily tilted for a lot of times towards the kind of glitz and glamour of that world. And of course, he had had that other side, too. It would have been interesting to see those what ifs that we always think about.
But as I said, he was very I think he felt a social responsibility to the poor, to immigrants, to everybody during the Depression, because he worked. He did a lot of charity work, as I said, for the Federation for the Support of Jewish Philanthropic Societies. And that was an organization of about 91 different hospitals, schools. And so he exhibited with some other photographers in these exhibitions that actually helped raise money and awareness for these charities. And then also used some of his images in their fundraising brochures.
Yeah, these images of children
in hospitals
are just hauntingly sad and beautiful at the same time. You know, the eyes of those kids looking at you. So to kind of wrap up here, the probably most popular photograph taken in 2018 is the selfie. There's this great image that Lucia did, which is kind of a selfie. And it's a selfie of him, Alfred Stieglitz, a group of other people, which may or may not include Georgia O'Keeffe, Alfred Stieglitz's wife.
Right.
And it's taken in the reflection of a hubcap.
Right.
Do you consider that a selfie of sorts?
Yeah. I think he's saying,
selfie.
I am a photographer taking a picture of a great photographer, Alfred Stieglitz, in his environment when he's casual. He doesn't have his art collector, art photographer, champion of modern art hat on. He is relaxing at home as an older man.
Smiling.
And he's saying, I am the photographer. Maybe I'm the next generation. Maybe I am Alfred Stieglitz's successor. But I also know enough about art and photography that I'm going to quote a photograph that Stieglitz took with O'Keeffe's hand pointing to a hubcap. So I found that really exciting that there is a direct quoting of an Alfred Stieglitz photograph.
This conversation.
There's a conversation. And I think he's putting himself in that conversation.
Well, that's cool. Well, thanks for having a conversation with us today. We had a good time.
It was so fun, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you. In 1989, controversial photographer Robert Mapplethorpe died of AIDS-related complications. The following year, the Contemporary Arts Center in Cincinnati, Ohio, opened a show of Mapplethorpe photographs called The Perfect Moment. On opening day, a grand jury handed down several indictments against the museum and its director, marking the first time in American history that a museum and director were charged criminally for obscenity. In October of 1990, the director and museum were found not guilty. The prosecution failed to convince the jury that Mapplethorpe's photographs lacked artistic merit. After the trial, defense lawyer H. Lewis Sirkin proclaimed the case a victory for the Bill of Rights. Quote, "This is a signal to everybody that before they start shutting down museums and telling people what they can say and what they can see, they better realize there is a protection out there, and it is the greatest document ever written." That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.